It's time for Let's Talk Legal with Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins from the law firm of Harvell and Collins. If you have a legal question, they can give you the answer. Call now at 252-222-4848.
And we'd like to welcome Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins to Let's Talk Legal. Good morning, Cecil.
Good morning. How are you?
I am fine. And Wes, I know you're out there too. Good morning, sir.
I'm here. Good morning.
Hey, I have a question that listeners have asked me over the past couple of days, and they said, ask those attorneys that come on your show on Tuesday. I said, well, that would be Harvell and Collins. Recently, we had an incident in the Swansboro area where a kayaker went missing and to this point is still missing and presumed lost, presumed dead. At what point does a family get closure in the sense of a death certificate and all that in a missing persons case? Have you ever come upon that?
I want Wes to chime in, but it is a case by case basis, Mike. I mean, sometimes folks, quite frankly, don't have death certificates for a year or more as a result of some sort of very extensive investigation.
Yeah.
So it can just linger on for a long, long time. And then of course there are other cases where there's been a tragedy such as this, but within, a reasonable amount of time, maybe 2-3 months, mm-hmm. there's some semblance of closure, but it very much is a case by case basis. Wes, what do you say?
Well, there's no question about that. Obviously, the circumstances, involving the missing person and what is suspected to have happened, plays a big part in that. The state, of course, has the authority to make that final determination, mm-hmm. Even if there's not, like in this case, a body found.
Right.
And it's a two-way street, and we talk about closure, but we also talk about wanting to continue to use due diligence to search for the person.
Sure.
Because once that death certificate is issued, then obviously there's no further efforts to try to locate the person.
I would have to look at the statute. I don't mind doing that between now and next week, but I do think that there is a presumption of death under certain circumstances after a number of years, and something makes me want to think 7 years, which is an awfully long time.
Yeah.
But I will confirm a number like that. But there are situations like that.
Sure.
There would be a statute on point that would dictate that absent any contrary evidence that there's a presumption that there is a death and the medical examiner can proceed with a certain type of death certificate after a certain period of time. But it's a long period of time. Don't you agree, Wes?
Yes. I mean, there's that presumption based on time, but that determination could be made before that time as well based on the evidence, even though a body has not been located.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, gentlemen. Yeah, I look forward to hearing that and learning about that too, Cecil. So we'll mm-hmm. give you that assignment for homework. Now, our topic of discussion for today, which is a part one of many parts. Yeah. What is it?
Well, Wes and I want to continue to explore the proceeding before the Superior Court known as a guardianship proceeding. Mm-hmm. We've talked about this before on the program. We have an uptick at our office in these files. They can become quite complex. Wes, of course, is our litigator. He is assisted in our office by Julia Sakely, who has become very knowledgeable in the area of guardianship law and is a big help to Wes. We had a case in Greene County. We've had cases in New Hanover County. Where they just have been, a real bugaboo. But the bottom line here, Mike, is that we all know that we need that durable power of attorney. I have taken in a case just here in the last day or two where the gentleman has great documents. I mean, he has a good power of attorney. He has a health care power of attorney. He has a last will and testament. He also is very, very fortunate because he has this one sibling who is extraordinarily competent and conscientious about this gentleman. But guess what? This gentleman has become belligerent. Mm. He has become hostile toward his agent under his documents, who happens to be this sibling. He is no longer cooperative. He will not stay in the hospital when he is hospitalized. He will not take his medications. He has locked this sibling out of his residence to the point, and he has no transportation, to the point that she has been unable to put the food in the residence that is needed. So clearly, Mike, obviously the gentleman has some issues, clearly, and it's sad and unfortunate, but there she is now, having good documentation, but he is constantly what we might call pulling the rug out from underneath her with regard to this documentation. He will not honor her decision-making financially, medically, residentially. All of those issues are out there. So she is, of course, at her wit's end, as one can imagine. She even fears for her own safety, because at one point there was some acting towards some threat of, if you will, physical contact. And so she now has had to seek out the advice of Harvell and Collins, mm-hmm. and Wes, of course, will take charge of that file and will place that in a litigation perspective before the clerk of court. And so we are seeing a lot of these kinds of files. That is a classic way in which the file frames up. Again, I know I'm maybe rattling on, but the client has documentation. This was the case with the file in Greene County that Wes had to travel to, has been there several times, actually. There was documentation, durable powers of attorney in place, but the gentleman and the wife of the gentleman were not honoring the documents, and so the children were forced into getting a court order.
You said we're seeing more of this now. Why do you think we're seeing more of this now, Cecil?
I'll let Wes talk.
Okay, Wes, why do you think we're seeing more of this now, as Cecil alluded to?
I have no idea. I'm convinced that after practicing for this many years that it's something to have to do with the solar system or the moon or something. Okay. I have no idea. Yeah. I mean, sometimes we just have certain types of files where there's just a run on certain types of circumstances that are presented to us. And then we don't hear about these particular type files for a period of time. I think it's somewhat coincidental. I don't think it's societal so much. I don't think there's like something going on in society that is affecting that. It's just circumstances are being presented in folks' lives, and they're needing the help of the court and our statutes as it relates to guardianship. But this is, as Cecil has described, you know, when we're dealing with guardianship cases, you know, most people think when we're talking about adult, because there's also guardianships for children, of course.
Yeah.
But when we're talking about an adult guardianship, most people think of that as a situation where we're dealing with your typical, you know, elderly person who has some type of cognitive decline. Normally, of course, what we talk about is the Alzheimer's situation, the dementia presentation type things, and the situation where the person just cannot handle their affairs anymore, and therefore it's necessary to have a guardian put in place to look after the best interest of the person if the power of attorney, if there's not a power of attorney, number one, and if the power of attorney, you know, number two, if it's not sufficient, you know, to handle whatever the particular issue is, because there's different types of power of attorney. Powers, mm-hmm. some of them are very detailed, have all the bells and whistles that we want to see. Some of them are not. So that's your typical situation.
Yeah.
But as Cecil described, we we oftentimes have situations where the person, the principal, is acting, you know, belligerently. I mean, they're acting in a in a way where they are not wanting to listen to reason. Put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
They're doing things that are a detriment to their estate. They may be willing to be subject to undue influence, you know, unknowingly. They may be, you know, being subjected to one of these stink scams that we hear about.
Yeah.
But they just won't listen to reason about it. They may be in a situation where they just want to fight their power of attorney on everything, even though the power of attorney clearly is doing things, trying to do things in the best interest of the principal. And that's, you know, you kind of have to strong arm them at that point in time through the guardianship process. If they are in a position where their capacity is diminished to a point where they can't make decisions for themselves in their best interest, and they may be a detriment to themselves, a detriment to their estate, or potentially even others. So in many cases, and I would say the majority of guardianship cases are not contested. And what I mean by that is that maybe 50-60% of them, it's a process that we go through, and it's obvious what the right decision is. Okay, it's obvious that this person needs a guardian. It's obvious that this child, for example, it should be the guardian, or even the spouse
mm-hmm.
should be the guardian. It's, you know, in many cases, it's very obvious. But then you have the cases where there are multiple aspects of the case that are not obvious, such as this person is clearly not acting in their best interest. They are being taken advantage of by scammers. But I'm not sure to a medical, from a medical perspective, they actually are lacking capacity to the point that a court will find that they should be adjudicated incompetent. And that's the threshold question, Mike.
You know,
if the person is not to a point where they're incompetent, then we don't even get to the question of whether there should be a guardian appointed and who that should be. So we're in many cases having to lean upon our medical experts.
Mm-hmm.
If we can have the person evaluated by their own physician, maybe in a routine type setting, we try to do that because obviously that's much less expensive compared to like a neuropsychological evaluation. Right. But in the event we have someone, a principal, who is not willing to go along with having themselves evaluated,
right?
Well, then we're having to go through the process that our general statutes afford us, which is to file a petition for what's referred to as a multidisciplinary evaluation. And an aspect of that would potentially be a neuropsych evaluation where the court orders the person to go through, you know, this battery of tests and examination to make a determination as to really what's going on with them cognitively.
Mm.
So again, a lot of times we go into these guardianships and we're not really sure what the expert opinion is going to be with regard to, you know, the cognitive impairment seems to be presenting itself.
Right.
We're lawyers. We're not doctors. We don't know.
Yeah.
We don't have the level of expertise to understand, you know, all the, you know, for example, mental illness that may be out there that we're dealing with in a particular guardianship. We have to rely upon those that are, you know, that can conduct those evaluations and then inform us in the court as to what's going on with the particular person.
Yeah, that makes sense. Let's take a pause on that note. We'll come back. We'll continue our discussion. We're talking with Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins. Let's Talk Legal. And we're talking about guardianship. We'll continue that conversation. If you'd like to have a conversation with Harvell and Collins, you can call 252-726-9050 or go online to harvellandcollins.com. We'll be right back.
Thank you.
And welcome back to Let's Talk Legal with Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins. We're talking about guardianship, and it's a continuing topic we'll be discussing here. Without the risk of jumping too far ahead, I was curious, if we go through all this effort, we have a, say, a belligerent parent who is being taken in by scammers, and we go and seek guardianship, and it gets adjudicated in our favor. What's to say that person's behavior changes? I mean, does this? How strong is a guardianship to prevent that type of behavior?
That's a great question, because there's really two aspects to the guardianship. I mean, there's really the personal aspect, meaning what is this person doing on a daily basis, medical care, who are they spending their time with? Are they being subjected to undue influence by others? Those type things. And then there's the financial part of it.
Yeah.
Are they writing checks, you know, to some scam in Africa?
Mm-hmm.
Are they, or wherever it may be?
Right.
Are they, do they have access to a credit card and they're running up their debt? Are they trying to get a loan on their house? So there's those two aspects. When we talk about the personal side of that, the guardianship itself, once that adjudication of incompetence is put in place and the guardian is appointed, that's not necessarily the magic potion,
mm-hmm.
to fixing whatever they're doing from a personal standpoint. They still might wander down the street, okay?
Right.
But, for example, but if they're wandering down the street in the middle of the night and you're not the guardian and there's not a guardian and you call the police to try to bring them back home and get them in a safe environment and the police show up or the sheriff's department shows up and the person says, the principal says, well, I'm fine. I want to just walk down the street at midnight. That's what I want to do. And there's no court order. Well, the police probably are not going to take that person back home.
Yeah.
Because you don't, as the guardian, you don't have, you might be the child, you might be the spouse, you don't have the authority to override their personal decision making.
Mm-hmm.
But if you have a court order that indicates you are the guardian, this person is adjudicated incompetent, and you show that court order and those letters of guardianship to the authorities, and say, what I want to happen for this person, my father, who's wandering down the street, is to take him home and get him back in a safe environment, then the police will do what you say to do. They will put him in the car and take him wherever, you know, within reason.
Yeah.
You say, because you have the right to override the decision making with regard to that person. As it relates to the financial part of it, well, once you're adjudicated incompetent, you don't have the capacity anymore, consistent with the terms of the court order, to be able to access your accounts. You don't have accounts anymore. You have a guardianship account, mm-hmm. that is under the control of the guardian. Okay? You don't have the capacity to enter contracts anymore. So if you were to, for example, make application for a credit card at a time after you've been adjudicated incompetent, even if that credit card were issued, you would not be responsible as the person who's been adjudicated for that debt on that credit card, because you didn't have the authority or ability to even enter a contract. So it is very powerful.
Yeah.
Right? It does really
it has
stop
made
the bleeding from a financial standpoint.
Yeah.
And it gives authority to the named guardian to be able to keep this person safe, even if this person doesn't agree with what you're recommending, say, to the police or whomever it may be.
Gentlemen, before we continue this answer and unpacking, and thank you, Wes, for that, we have a caller from Cape Carteret that has a question for you. Hunter, you're on with Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins. Hunter, go ahead.
Yes, I had a quick question. So, say there is an estate, and there's the will, and the will says something for a property, but the deed does not work in line with the will, and so basically someone can take something because it was deeded one way, but that does not necessarily follow the will. So is there anything that you can do to try to make what was in the will happen?
Well, yeah,
okay.
Hunter, I think that you're doing your very best to put together a great question, but that, you know, there's just going to, we would have to see more facts and circumstances and the documents. You know, what does the will say? What does the deed say? What a, kind of a comparative analysis to be able to kind of advise what's kind of happening here. There, it is true that sometimes deeds don't conform in their language descriptions or whatever with what is in the will, but it might be that the property also in the will, there's a catch-all, like the rest, residue, and remainder of my property. So it really would be a matter of kind of putting the pieces of the puzzle together here to give you some sort of definitive statement. How long ago was it, did this conflict or concern arise?
The estate is still open. However, it has been about four and a half, five years now since the person has passed away.
Cecil, we have 45 seconds left.
Yeah. Well, you should gather up your information and definitely, just based on me hearing what you're saying, you know, seek some legal advice. Get the paperwork together that you have. If you don't have it, then you have at least what's in your memory bank, and seek legal advice to see what if anything can be done.
Thank you, Hunter, and Cecil. I'll give you or Wes the close. We have about 30 seconds left. We're taking it right to the top.
Mentioned briefly to Hunter that, you know, this is your classic situation where probably a 15-20 minute sit down, look at the documents, discuss it, answers the question conclusively for Hunter. We have to see those documents. It is a, you know, 15-20 minute period of time, maybe 30 minute period of time. That's this type of what we call initial consultation is free. There's no risk. It doesn't cost you anything. But the advice that you get could be worth, a lot.
Very immeasurable. Good advice there, Wes, to conclude our conversation today, which will continue next Tuesday. And Hunter, you and others can call Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins at 252-726-9050. Again, that phone number, 252-726-9050. HarvellandCollins.com.